members, we're going to get going. We don't have a quorum yet, but folks from Utah are kind of on a tight schedule, and so are we. So, Representative O'Driscoll, if you want to come forward and introduce your guests, we'll start. They're going to do a presentation, Ms. Bird and Mr. Carter from two different organizations in Utah. They'll introduce themselves when they come, but Representative O'Driscoll, if you want to introduce them, and then we'll get going, and when we have a quorum, we'll bring the meeting officially to order. Welcome, Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'd like to, without much further ado, introduce Kevin Carter, who is responsible for the management of the Utah trust lands that have been put aside in the Constitution in the state of Utah, and the state of Minnesota also has a similar activity as a result of our statehood. And I'm proposing a bill that we'll be back in the future to talk about with the committee that will change the way that we manage and those particular assets for the state of Minnesota and the school children. And we also have present with us Margaret Bird, who is with the Department of Education in the state of Utah. And I'd like to have them come forward and just do some informational gathering and sharing with the committee this morning.
Well, thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. And we do have a quorum. So welcome, Ms. Bird and Mr. Carter, and go ahead with your presentation. I understand it's going to take about 15 minutes.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you again.
I represent the State Office of Education, who is the beneficiary of the trust, but I'm also the director of the Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools, or CLASS for short. and CLASS is an organization of all the states in the country that still have school trust lands. There are approximately 45 million acres of lands held in trust for schools in the U.S., and there are $49 billion in permanent funds that support education. These trusts that were created in each state are sacred, irrevocable trusts. The fiduciary duty that is imposed on every state that received school trust lands is as follows. A trustee is held to something stricter than the morals of the marketplace. Not honesty alone, but the punctilio of an honor the most sensitive. The punctilio of an honor the most sensitive is then the standard of behavior. The level of conduct for fiduciaries has been kept at a level higher than that trodden by the crowd. That is the duty that is imposed on every state when the school lands were granted to support schools. So this is a grant that was made in the Enabling Acts. It was a significant portion of your Enabling Act and a significant and important part of what you agreed to in order to become a state. So I want to make sure that it's clear to everyone this is not like the trust, the various trusts that get created, that are created now that you can make adjustments to. Rather, this is a trust that you agreed to as a condition of statehood. There are Supreme Court decisions in every single state, from state Supreme Courts up to the U.S. Supreme Court, on this fiduciary duty and that obligation that has been imposed on the state. Those obligations include undivided loyalty, accountability to the beneficiaries for how the trust is used, making trust property productive of revenue, not commingling accounts, not mixing accounts in with other properties, obtaining the best possible price, informing the beneficiary, and preserving that trust for future generations of school children. When we made the changes in Utah in 1994, there was opposition to change from every major lobbying group in the state of Utah. It's not surprising because change is difficult for us as humans. We always seem to prefer where we are right now versus the unknown change. But it was also particularly important and opposed in Utah because land is something people care passionately about. The opposition came from the ranching and agriculture community, the environmental community, petroleum, mining, Department of Natural Resources, where the trust had been housed prior to that, forestry, fire control, some of the education groups, the Association of Counties. Our legislature, when they were looking at this trust issue in 94, recognized that they could not change the prior history of abuse. You have not abused your trust in Minnesota to anything like the degree that we did in Utah, where we were the poster child for the lowest permanent fund, the worst managed lands, the lowest fees in every category you could name. But they chose at that point, when they became aware of these lands being held in trust by the state, they decided to honor that fiduciary duty that they had and to honor that punctilio of honor that was so sensitive. They removed the trust from the Department of Natural Resources, set up the trust to make money using a corporate structure, and they made the trust quasi-independent. Because of these changes, you can see the increase in our permanent fund. That lower number on the far left portion of the graph is $18 million was our low point, and then we went up from there. I am pleased to let you know that at this point, with the changes in the management and managing this trust for the school children, we now have the support of every one of those groups that once opposed us. And that is not that's because we honored the fiduciary duty, but we also were good citizens in how we managed that trust. Really want to emphasize that there isn't a group that opposed it initially that's still in opposition to it now.
Welcome, Mr. Carter. You could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Thank you. My name is Kevin Carter, and I'm the director of Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration. I'm also a past president of the Western States Land Commissioners Association, an organization of all of the land commissioners in the West, and I'm currently serving as the chairman of the Western Regional Partnership, which is a group of state and federal land management agencies throughout the Western United States. I've been involved in trust land management for a little over 30 years now. Prior to the change in Utah, the model for state land management in Utah trust lands was similar to what you have in Minnesota. There was a executive director of a Department of Natural Resources. The executive director was a cabinet-level position in the governor's office. There were agencies within the department that managed wildlife, state parks, regulated oil, gas, and mining, and managed school trust lands and other state lands. There was the state land board that served as an advisory and policy board. The director served at the pleasure of the executive director of the Department of Natural Resources, although in reality serving at the pleasure of the governor. Revenues from the trust subsidized a number of other activities that were taking place inside the Division of State Lands and Forestry. The management focus was patterned after federal land management agencies like the BLM. Almost all of the employees of the agency were merit or civil service type employees. After 1994, when the change was made, the agency was separated from the Department of Natural Resources and established as a quasi-independent state agency, which meant that although there was a nexus with the governor's office at the time of the appointment of the director, that was about the only nexus that occurred. The director of the agency is appointed for a four-year term, as I mentioned, with the concurrence of the governor at the time of appointment. The agency is self-funded. All of our funding comes from our earnings. No tax dollars are used to run the operation. We perform all of our activities focused on fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries, and all of the employees except for clerical employees now are at will in the agency, and so they've given us essentially a business model to follow, and that's the model that we're using right now. There's a significant expectation of accountability. for the office. You can see in this blow-up of this table, this is a portion of a report that's created every year.
Excuse me, Mr. Carter. Members, we do not have these overheads, but they will be sent to us, and we will forward them all to you because they're very interesting tables and such. But you do not have them in your packet, but they're going to highlight them, and we will get them to you. Continue, Mr. Carter.
Thank you for that clarification. And so, for example, on this table that's on the slide right now, the far right column shows part of a report that we look at every month that describes every activity that we're involved in, its revenues and its costs, so that we can determine that everything that we're doing is making more money than it's costing us. If a program gets below one, then we seriously look at if we're doing the right thing, if we should be doing it any longer. And so the type of accountability you would expect of a trustee. The net revenues since we began have increased significantly. If you would have taken the far left column backwards 20 years, it would have been about that same location. We averaged about $10 to $15 million a year net revenue. And then since the creation of the administration in 94, that's grown and followed market trends. And we've been over $140 million some years and averaged around $75 to $80 million. So in comparison to the $10 million where we were at before. We believe that a focus on the fiduciary duty of a trustee does not mean that you don't take care of stewardship or conservation issues, and that both can be done. An example in this case would be cultural resources, which we have some significant cultural resources on trust lands in Utah. This particular slide shows what's called the Great Hunt. You can see obviously why it's named that. The Native Americans are hunting bighorn sheep in this case. And this panel is on a piece of school trust land in central Utah. This gives you a broader view. The oval in the center shows where that panel is. And then if you notice on the far right and the far left of the picture, there are red arrows. Those arrows are pointing to where a road previously came through this area, and that road made a bend right there where this panel was, and the road was so close to this panel that the mirrors on the trucks could scour the rock. And so in order to protect this resource, we worked with a mineral lessee who has this land lease for mineral development. We realigned the road, put up barricades, and put in the nice facilities you see here now so that people can still come and enjoy this resource, but that it's protected. We also spend a lot of time and effort protecting endangered plants and animals. The plant on the right is the dwarf bearclaw poppy, which is a federally listed threatened species. Although there is not a legal requirement to protect endangered plants on non-federal lands if there's not a federal nexus, we still have made arrangements to make sure that the habitat for this plant has been protected while we try to find a way to get it out of our ownership and into federal ownership so that it can be protected under the federal government. The picture on the left, the desert tortoise, the largest intact piece of desert tortoise habitat in the nation right now is on school trust land in southern Utah. And we're providing the protection for this species. And don't find a conflict in doing that with our mandate to provide revenue for the school children. We've got 3.5 million acres of land that we're managing, and although some of it has situations like this on it, we find that we can focus our revenue generating responsibilities on other pieces that aren't sensitive for animals or plant habitat, and find ways to at the same time move sensitive habitat out of our ownership and into the ownership of an agency who has that as part of their mandate. There are even opportunities to use endangered species or critical habitat situations to benefit the beneficiaries of the trust. For example, this is the Utah prairie dog, a federally listed species, and their habitat right now is in an urban area. They are encroaching upon a community in southern Utah, and they like golf courses and cemeteries and people's backyards. They like places where the overstory's been mowed down so they can see raptors. That's their biggest threat is from raptors, and so they like human habitat. But unfortunately, the humans aren't so happy about it because they're pretty aggressive. They'll charge you in your backyard, and they're certainly not a threat physically, but they are known carriers of Sylvatic plague. And so there is some hesitation to interface with them to a great deal. But we found an opportunity where we have trust land away from urban areas that is good habitat for the prairie dog that we have dedicated and made available for transplanting of these animals from people's backyards and civic areas into an area where they're away from people and still can increase the numbers and hopefully move the population on to a delisting. And we've been able to do this and actually make money doing it by allowing people to buy credits to move the prairie dogs from their homes, their lots, into this preservation area. So we believe that there's a way that you can fulfill your mandate as a trustee and still provide for environmental protection. We have a lot of sensitive lands in Utah that, as a trustee for a school trust, we're probably not the best people for long-term ownership, and we need to look for ways to get it out of our ownership and into federal ownership or a private, like a nature conservancy type ownership, where they do have that mandate and that responsibility. This particular arch is the Corona Arch. It is on school trust land in Utah. A little bit difficult to see, but right there, if you look at that spot right there on the picture, those are people underneath that arch, to give you an idea how big that arch is. There are photographs in the local community, this is near Moab, Utah, of an airplane flying through that arch. And so it is a big arch. And if you think that perhaps there's nothing else you can do with a piece of property like this other than look at it, I can assure you that's not the case. Yeah, if you want to go to YouTube and type in Corona Arch, there's probably two or three dozen different videos of people taking that plunge. Since we were created in 1994, we've set aside over 550,000 acres for preservation, which exceeds the total number of acres protected by every conservation and preservation group in the state combined. And so although we do have a mandate to use these lands to generate revenues for the schools, we believe that it can be done in a way that is sensitive to the environment. And thank you for the opportunity to address you today.
Thank you, Ms. Lugarder and Ms. Bird. Representative Wiggins, you had a question earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was back on your slide on accountability, and I wanted to ask the question, I think I could see it correctly, but where your monies come from and how many acres produce that revenue? I mean, I see oil and gas. Do you have percentages of where those coal?
Generally, we have 3.5 million acres of surface that we manage, and then an additional million acres that we only own the mineral estate.
Representative Wiggin, I'm sorry, Director Carter, continue. Did you have a further answer?
I'm sorry.
No. Representative Wiggin, has follow-up?
Yes, I I am seeing that your revenues come from oil and gas and coal. We don't have those revenues.
Right.
And it looks like that's a high percentage of your revenues. Can you tell us how what percentage of your revenues come from oil, gas, and coal?
Generally, thank you. Generally, year in, year out, about 75%.
75%. From coal. And it would be my guess, but I don't know, that that is on, well, I'm not even going to guess. How many acres of your 3.5 million produce that oil, gas, and coal?
Director Carter.
Revenue.
Let's see, the coal would be not very many, probably less than 5,000 acres would be involved in coal. Oil and gas, probably 1.5 million acres is leased for oil and gas, and production is occurring on a much, much smaller footprint, probably the low thousands of acres.
Representative Wiginian.
And how much from managing timber?
Director Carter.
Normally, revenues from timber production in Utah, the net is $2 to $6 million a year.
$2 to $6 million
Representative
a year net. Okay. Yes. This is a money committee understanding where they're getting their revenues and comparing them to, I mean, the expectation is, gee, we can do just exactly what Utah does, but we don't have coal, we don't have gas, we don't have, well, we'd have a lot of forestry, but your net income from timber is not very much.
Correct.
How about your net income from selling land?
Director Carter.
There are two mechanisms that we use for land sales. We sell land at auction, raw land, probably less than 5,000 acres a year, and that income is in the low millions of dollars. We also do real estate development, where we develop residential property in urban settings that we have, and that has, when the market was good a couple of years ago, that was in the $30 to $40 million range. And this year it'll be much, much less. Last year it was much less, less than $5 million.
Representative Guinea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That raises the question, and I don't know the answer to it. Do we have any trust lands near urban areas?
Representative Guinea, we have 8 trust land lots in the city limits of Gilbert. I believe they're within the city limits of Gilbert. Eveleth at the airport, at the Eveleth Airport, and the DNR at our instructions put that property up for sale last year. They're actually served by city sewer and water and did not get any bids for that property.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, could I follow up on
that? You sure can. Representative Wiginian.
So we're looking at where you get income compared to where we could get income. Where do you see us getting income? I mean, you're advocating your model, but how does your model translate to where we could produce income?
Ms. Byrd.
As I said, I'm the director of CLASS that involves all the states that have trust lands. And many of the states, Idaho's second largest revenue source is from cottage sites.
It's from what?
Cottage sites that they locate on the different lakes that they have in Idaho. We don't have lakes in Utah, but you have beautiful lakes here. And I understand you have a lot of miles of shoreline here. You have Trona. We don't have Trona. And that produces a large amount of revenue. In fact, it is equal to the forestry revenue that you receive, at least in 2010 on the last study that we did. We haven't completed the 2011 study of all the states. So you have many areas. And then I also noticed on the web that they were putting windmills on Trona Ridge, not on school trust lands, however. But I understand that you have a number of areas where it's a high wind area, that might be a possibility. There are a lot of things that different states are getting involved in some of these large cables that are passing through school trust lands. Have been a huge source of revenue in many of the states. So there are a lot of sources that if you were run more like a business, someone would be exploring the opportunity to make that revenue, whereas right now, I believe you only have 2 acres under lease out of 2.5 million acres. You only have 2 acres that are under lease for about $1,500 in 2010 for residential.
Representative Wagenius.
So I'm getting the idea that if we were to lease out some of this land that is available, then you would then manage the you would manage that, putting in roads and all that kind of thing. That would become under your purview rather than DNR's.
If I could to elaborate, that's a good question, Representative Wagenius. Mr. Carter, I remember in previous conversations you mentioned something about a lawsuit and access to school trust land. Could you elaborate when you answer Representative Wagenius's thoughts about blowing a road into school trust land, the lawsuit that you talked about?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, certainly, what we are advocating, if we're advocating anything at all, is that it's not so much the resources that you have; it's the duty that you believe you have to develop them and manage them, and the way that you approach it that makes the difference. And so, in talking about development and those types of things, where you would have to bring in access. There are a lot of lands in Utah that are surrounded by federal lands. The majority of our land base is surrounded by Bureau of Land Management or Forest Service or some other federal land management agency. And the federal courts in Utah have ruled that the federal government has the obligation to provide access into our in-held school trust lands, even if it's within a wilderness study area, that right of access is there. So we have yet to use that, to force that, but that right is there, that right to gain access, even if your lands are within a national forest or some type of forest recreation area. There is a recognized right in the federal courts to get the access that you need into those lands to develop them economically. And that's a court case out of Utah, the federal district court in Utah.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Last question, Mr. Chair. So if, under the scenario here, if we were developing lake lots and there was no access, then the state, if it was probably state lands, not federal lands, then the state would need to provide the access. Are you anticipating that the revenues from the school trust land would pay for that access? Or are you saying that we then would have to pay for that access?
Director Carter.
In Utah, we would only do that if we believe that the development of the land would pay for the access necessary to develop it. That would be the point of acquiring the access.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to Minnesota. Mr. Carter, you described how you are involved in protection of endangered species and endangered plants. Could you describe how that fits into your accounting model, or do you kind of set that activity aside and do that on a different basis than the economic model?
Director Carter.
For the situation with the prairie dog, where we're actually finding an economic way to take advantage of the designation by selling credits, it would be accounted for in one of the programs. Yeah, on one of the programs here. On the other situations like the desert tortoise or let's talk about the desert tortoise. Primarily, we don't spend any money to do anything because there's nothing that we can do. As far as management costs, there's very little management cost. The cost comes to us in trying to exchange it to the federal government. And so and that's not shown in these figures here because it's a separately administered area of the agency in trying to reposition our assets. And so it would be a separate function that we would perform looking ahead to acquiring different land that would have income potential that would fall into one of the categories that we generally use and lease lands for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think I follow that, Mr. Carter. So in the case of a piece of property that would have an endangered species on it, you'd be looking for an opportunity to trade land with the federal government, or would you be looking for an opportunity for the federal government to purchase that land from you?
Director Carter.
Normally, our experience with the federal government is that they are land rich and money poor. And so they have rarely been able to come to the table with a purchase. Now, there have been some exceptions, and they have used Land and Water Conservation Fund to purchase desert tortoise habitat from us. But of the 10,000 acres of tortoise habitat that we have, over the last 15 years, they've been able to come up with money to purchase about 500 acres. So at that rate, it'll be a long time before they buy it all from us. The dwarf bear claw poppy, alternatively, we've been selling that habitat to the Nature Conservancy, and they've acquired probably 75% of the poppy habitat that we had on our lands over the last 10 years.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. So when you do sell land, do you then put that money into your trust, or do you go out and purchase other land?
Director Carter.
We do not have the legal authority to go out and purchase other land, so all of the money we get on sales goes directly into our trust.
Thank you very much.
And Director Carter, at the pace you're selling land, how long will it last?
It'll last another 3.5 centuries.
Thank you. Representative Canoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wagenius's questions kind of got this issue. I'm curious of how it works in more urban or developed or areas. And do you do land swaps in order to get land that you see would be more developable? Or I'm just curious of how that would work, not just selling land, but trading land with another entity. And then you said you do housing developments. Do you have any other urban developments or suburban or sort of developments of any kind other than extractive ones?
Director Carter.
Normally, the land that's being developed for residential and commercial development right now is land that we acquired several decades ago in anticipation of a community growing out to us. And so we're doing the same thing now in preparation for the next 30 years out. And so when we do land exchanges, primarily with the federal government, we look at those types of lands that are in the path of long-term urban growth that we can acquire. And then normally the developments that we do, we bring land to the table. We partner with someone in the private sector who does the actual construction. They bring capital to do the improvements. They construct residential homes or sometimes commercial buildings and put them on the market and sell them, and we split the proceeds based on our respective equities in the project.
Director Burke.
We also, there was a proposal a number of years ago for wilderness in the West Desert of Utah and the mountains on the West Desert, and that was unsuccessful in getting through Congress. But a portion of that had been a land exchange. So we then went forward to Congress with just the land exchange portion and were able to exchange out of lands that really brought very little revenue from this West Desert area and able to trade into other areas. And one of those areas now that we acquired, when we were looking at what to acquire, we found a 2,000-foot deposit of salt. And into that salt, they're now using solution mining to carve out huge, kind of like a pop bottle shaped underground container that can be used to store natural gas, but it also can be used to store electricity in non-peak times so that the electricity is stored there and then it's brought back out to run the turbines and provide the electricity and help the environment that way. So we acquire all sorts of things, not just, don't want to leave the impression that this is an agency that's solely focused on oil and gas or coal, but it's focused on all sorts of activities, both, you know, environmental ones also, such as that one, that that help generate money for the schools, but it also provides community jobs, and it's very important. The counties have become very supportive because it has generated tax revenue that then supports their local communities.
Follow up, Representative Canute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, to be, my understanding, you can't acquire land through purchase, but you can do land swaps, is my understanding. And then, how does the local tax base, once, I mean, if you're developing residential or commercial property, how does the school trust land revenue interact with the local tax base, the property tax base? Or
Director Carter.
I do want to clarify one thing. We can purchase property. I just can't sell property and use those proceeds to purchase property. But if I have money in my budget, I can, and I have on occasion purchased property for strategic purposes. And we pay, while the land is in our ownership, we make a payment in lieu of taxes to local counties. And then once it's leased by a partner, then the property taxes are paid by our partner at the full rate that as if it was private land. So during that build-up period, the land is contributing to local tax levies in the same way as if it was private land. And then once it's developed and sold, then it would be just like any other private land.
Thank you. Director Byrd, could you elaborate? I believe you talked about earlier in one of the previous meetings I sat in, the number of students in Utah and how much money per student approximately. You talked about it, how it's not quite proportional per student, but how many students are in the state of Utah and how much per student did they get in 1994 and how much will they get approximately in 2012?
We didn't discuss this because we had a very short time period, but all the revenue that's generated, all the net revenue that's generated by the Trust Lands Administration all goes into our permanent fund. The permanent fund distributed about 15 to 20 million in 1994 to schools, but no one knew what it purchased because it just went into the big school pot. It went in unidentified, and so the schools weren't even aware of how much they were receiving for the trust. Couldn't point to one thing, one difference that it made. Now what happens is that revenue is distributed to every single school, traditional public school or charter school in our state. There is a committee in each school that's a majority of parents elected by the parents, teachers elected by the teachers, and the principal. And that school community council, we call it, there are about 8,000 members in the state, and they make the decision at their school about what their most pressing academic need is. So one school might have reading as a pressing need. Another school might be largely children that don't speak English, and they might be hiring aides to help the children come up to speed on English faster. The science labs throughout the state are largely supported from the trust dollars. Most of the computer labs are in part supported from the trust land dollars. The first year that we got the school land trust program in place, and you can go to the website schoollandtrust.org and see this information. It's completely transparent. You can see the plan every year for every single school. But the first year we got that, the money distributed was about just under $5 million. I am anticipating we will send $30 million out this coming school year from the interest and dividends from the trust. It's making a huge difference. We've gone from no one in the state knowing that there is such a thing as school trust lands to 75% recognition that it's helping in their community. Because the books the kids bring home and the computers they use at school, all of the extras, the smart boards, the professional development are all funded from this source. It is hugely important to our schools because it's been increasing each year, not decreasing like most other things that we have. Of our 550,000 students, the distribution is 90% is distributed on a per pupil basis statewide. 10% is distributed evenly among the school districts. Like you, we have some school districts with very low population, small number of students. And so the disparity there is probably our largest school district gets about $50 a student. Our smallest school district gets over $500 a student.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some questions about the slide that's on the up right now. Trying to get a little better handle on what some of these things are with development. I see telecommunications. Is that like cell phone tower leasing or, Mr. Chair?
Director Carter.
Yes, it is.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, I see the industrial is the largest of the subgroups among the development. Could maybe you explain what some of that industrial development is?
Director Carter.
It's a very diverse group of activities. For example, one of the leases that we have in the industrial category is a rocket sled test track on the top of a mesa where they test ejection seats and other things for airplanes. And then another example of an industrial use would be a compressor station for a natural gas pipeline or a water evaporation pond. And industrial parks. We have several industrial parks where we jointly worked with local governments to create an industrial park for, you know, whatever industry they can coax in.
Follow-up, Representative Haynes.
Mr. Chair, there's probably a YouTube of that rocket ejection seat thing as well. And then I see the residential, so that's leasing or sale for housing. I think you mentioned that. Is that correct?
The residential category here, it would be for cabin sites. Leasing of cabin sites would be that category.
Representative Hansen.
And then, Mr. Chair, governmental, that's what would that be? Is that state, federal, local? Maybe if you could explain what the government.
It would be all of those. We have some leases to the federal government for tracking stations for Air Force training areas. We have leases to communities for water tanks. We have leases to counties for landfills and for shooting ranges. Just any number of governmental type activities that occur.
And Representative Hansen.
Finally, Mr. Chair, I see easements on there. Are there any leases or easements for hunting and fishing activities, or is that what is the access question for public use?
Director Carter.
This category of easements is primarily easements for roads and pipelines, telephone lines, power lines. We have an agreement with our state wildlife agency where they make a payment to us every year that provides public access onto all school trust lands in the state for hunting, fishing, trapping, and wildlife viewing.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. Mr. Carter, going back to your slide referring to the rather dramatic increases in revenue since 1994, and then you mentioned that a lot of the revenue is from the sale of oil, gas, and coal. We all know what's happened to the price of those commodities in the last 15, 20 years. Do you have any figures showing how much of those increases in revenue are caused by inflation and how much by increased activity?
Director Carter.
In our case, it's a combination of both, although increased activity is a larger component than price increases. Natural gas right now is actually lower than it's been in a decade or more, and so and that's a significant issue for us. Oil prices, of course, are very high, but oil is probably the lowest of the three that's a product on our lands. Natural gas and coal would be bigger. Coal prices are up a little bit, but not dramatically over the course of that time. It's been almost all a function of getting more resources on the market.
follow-up. Representative Anderson.
Yeah, just one more quick question. I'd hope somebody else would have asked this because I hate to show my lack of understanding, but I'm not quite sure what the meaning of the term punctilio of an honor is. So maybe, Mr. Chair, you could help me out, or could we ask Ms. Bird on that?
Representative Anderson, I have a history of interrupting people and asking them to explain words. So you know I'm not going to – I can't even repeat it. So if one of the testifiers could explain to Representative Anderson and myself the meaning of the word.
It is the standard to which a trustee is held. It means – it is a word for saying the penultimate, the highest level of honor. Because as you recall from the quote, it says that a trustee's – standard of duty is not that of the marketplace. And though we tend to look backwards and say, oh, things were so honorable back in the 1920s when this court case came, and, you know, things are so rotten right now, things weren't so great in the 1920s either. So the court was trying to make a point that you are held to the very highest level of duty when there is a trust and a beneficiary involved.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Director Carter, thank you folks for being here. In the district that I have the pleasure to represent, I have the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, which has 90,000 plus acres of school prep in. And I'm going back many questions ago to Representative Wagenius and Chair McNamara when you were talking about the federal interpretation or the federal lawsuit that forced access and you hadn't used it yet. Most of our lands that are in that wilderness area since 1964 are water access. Did that ruling, was it such a ruling that would allow for the use of the federal's water and land? And the point I'm trying to get at is, do we really probably, but maybe by precedent, already have access to lands that we don't know that we have access to through a former court ruling? And that we haven't exercised them for our own development of our own lands that are landlocked within this 1.25 million or whatever the number is, acres of federal designated wilderness. And you also said in your testimony that you referenced federal recreational areas, but I didn't hear you say Big W wilderness, meaning designated wilderness by Congress. Can you address that?
Director Carter.
It is my belief that the ruling of the court in that case would allow for access regardless of the type of access required, because it was based on the economic development of the inheld school trust lands. And the court's ruling was that the federal government had the obligation to provide for economic access to develop those trust lands, that it was a prior recognition of an action by the Congress. And in a separate ruling in the Tenth Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals used language like, this enabling act grant of lands to the state created a solemn compact between the federal government and the states. And the federal government has the obligation to allow the states to develop these lands that they granted to the states for that purpose. And so from reading those two cases together, I would assume that, yes, it doesn't matter what type of access is necessary to economically develop those trust lands, that access is required.
Follow up, Representative Dill.
And just a comment, I could see an oar boat sailing across the Boundary Waters, a 1,000-foot laker. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This brings up all sorts of fascinating questions that we haven't addressed. So I'm back to your fiduciary duty and your, you know, this high moral standard. Say we have lots and lots of school trust lands that are hunted on now, but no money from that activity goes into the trust fund. Is there an obligation under the fiduciary duty to make sure the DNR puts some money into the pot, the school trust pot, for allowing people to hunt and fish on these lands?
Director Carter.
The situation that brought that to a point in Utah was that the legislature had established a program known as cooperative wildlife hunting units, or management areas, yes, cooperative wildlife management areas. And what this program allowed for was a private landowner could take his land and put it into this cooperative wildlife management area. And by doing that, he would be given a certain number of hunting tags. And he would have to allow the several members of the general public who previously did not have access to his private land, they would be able to go on his private land and hunt, and then the other tags he could sell or use himself. And they, it's a very lucrative program for landowners. And the reason that the Wildlife Agency was willing to do it was that it did allow public access on private land for at least some hunters by doing this. And so there was that public good that they saw. But the landowner then had a couple of permits that he could sell himself, and it became a very lucrative business for these landowners. We were precluded from doing that on our lands. And so alternatively, we negotiated an agreement with our wildlife agency for a payment every year that opened up all of our lands for all hunting and fishing and trapping.
Follow up, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. That's the point I was trying to get at. If this all this land goes into separate management, and there's a lot of it that's available for hunting and fishing, then there would be need to be some way to capture some funds from the hunting and fishing community to put in the school trust fund. I mean, there may be different kinds of mechanisms, but in order to follow the fiduciary duty, you'd have to figure out something.
If there was a market to do that, if there was a market to do that in the state, if that was a marketable commodity, then yes, I would say perhaps. So if it's not a marketable commodity in your state, then not necessarily.
Well,
Representative Wagenius.
In this state, we're buying land hand over fist because we don't have enough land for hunting and fishing, and a lot of this land is now hunted and fished upon.
Director Byrd.
The beneficiaries are the school children. So isn't that fair that they be compensated in way for the hunting and fishing? Because after all, the wildlife resources is compensated through the licenses. Shouldn't a portion of that be buying that access? It just seems like a fairness issue to me to the beneficiaries. Thank you.
Thank you. To this point, Representative Deal.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Mr. Carter. So I heard you say the word agreement. So do you have we have in Minnesota, we're using conservation easements on large tracts of private land, paper timber company land. Mm-hmm. Do you have a conservation easement, or you just simply have a written agreement with your wildlife people?
We have a written agreement. We have a written agreement for a 10-year term.
To this point, I'm sorry, Representative Deal.
Yes, sir, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. And is there can we read off of here and kind of interpolate what the payments might be for that land? I totally agree that that land should be, we should be getting something into the school trust for using it for hunting and fishing for the general populace, including non-residents that come to the state. But is there a way to interpolate off of your chart?
Director Byrd.
We have about 1 million acres more than you have in terms of surface. And the payment this year, I believe, is $575,000.
It's in the commercial category on that table.
So, Mr. Chairman, about 350 or 300, thank you, Mr. Chair, about 300,000 in figuring what Minnesota would be if you have a third more. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, they do have to get going. They're actually going to go over and try and convince the governor of this being a good idea, so they're going to meet with him shortly. I just have a couple of points. Director Byrd, I hear you talk about other states. A lot of the talk, because one of our biggest assets is the forestry component. Other states, you've been involved with in other states, have forestry. I heard Director Carter talk about the forestry in Utah, but we didn't talk about the percentage of how the return is to school trust land in relation to either by acres or by costs incurred. We've had times here in the state of Minnesota where unfortunately the costs have been for years been as much as the revenue we've brought in. How do other states that you've been involved in where forestry is a larger component of the school trust land, how do they come out as expenses to revenue? If you could just real quickly just touch on that as some other states and how that is, and then how you've seen that compared to here in Minnesota.
Idaho is well managed in terms of their forestry, and they spend as much as 30%.
When you say 30%, Director Bird, will you explain it?
Of the revenue that they make, 30% goes to cover their cost on the forestry. 70% goes to the beneficiary. In Washington State, it has been in flux. They have a new land manager there that I think is doing a much better job in terms of increasing the revenue. Washington State was as high as $600 million a year at one point before they had the spotted owl. And they still spend most years under 35% in Washington State.
Director Bird, you were afraid to talk about Oregon, but I like to hear the good and bad. I have no idea. I know Oregon a little bit from the nursery industry. Tell us the story on Oregon in 1 minute.
We've been watching Oregon's timber revenue drop every year, year after year. They have implemented some practices that are probably not benefiting the school children in Oregon.
Are they constitutional?
I don't know. The courts haven't decided on it.
Okay, thank you. Director Bird, that brings
But me. I think spending everything is definitely not going to meet muster in the courts.
Okay, thank you. And that brings me to my next point. Director Carter, you've talked about court cases, and we'd like to keep Minnesota out of the courts on this issue, but it seems like we're really in some bad territory right now. You have used an entrepreneurial spirit. I don't know, Representative Anderson, if I got that right word right, but I was thinking of people that are thinking along the lines that you are. I think constitutionally we're required to do that on school trust land, to actually be thinking of how best can we obey the laws that we're supposed to obey, follow the Constitution of the United States and Minnesota, but maximize the benefit for the kids. And when I think of maximizing the benefit, I'm thinking of the revenue. Because the more money you make, and you talk about all these unique ideas and everybody's saying, well, that's a good idea. But if I remember right, Utah wasn't doing this. They were sitting back and it was a good old boys club kind of deal. And you talked about how they were leasing land for pennies when all of a sudden when somebody thought about it, it should be dollars. It seems like we have a constitutional requirement to do this. How do you deal with them? We've got statutes that some of this stuff you're saying and talking about doing, we've got statutes that don't go consistent with that. So how does that work? Representative Wagenius has talked about how maybe we should try and get revenue from hunting and stuff, but we actually have a statute that says we're supposed to manage this land for environmental purposes. I don't think that's consistent with the Constitution. When we put that in, that tells the DNR they're supposed to do that. Well, they're the DNR. They're going to do it that way. They're not going to maximize it for the kids. I think we're on the brink here of a lawsuit if we don't deal with this. And I'm just wondering if you can hit on that a little bit, and the governor may have to wait for a minute because I see a few hands popping up. Director Carter.
Certainly the obligation of a trustee is to have undivided loyalty to the beneficiaries of the trust. And that's a complicated matter in these type for a governmental trust, because you also have other constitutional duties and responsibilities. One of the things that our Attorney General has opined about is that the legislature, it's probably not appropriate for the legislature to impose restrictions on trust lands that are also not imposed upon private lands. So if the standard on management of trust lands is over and above what a private landowner can do on his lands in Minnesota, then perhaps you are creating some constitutional problems. If, however, those regulations are across the board and every landowner is equally affected, then maybe not so much. And those are things that you would have to weigh in the balance and determine, you know, whether you're imposing an additional burdens or duties upon trust land management that's not there to the average landowner. So those would be things that we have looked at and we have asked our legislature to consider as we move forward. And this is a continuously evolving process.
Director Byrd.
I believe you're in a very, very precarious spot right now. I cannot think of a case in which beneficiaries have brought a lawsuit on school trust lands that the beneficiaries have not been successful. And I'm talking 150 years of case law in the United States. I think the way out of the difficult position you're in is to treat this trust, now that you've become aware of it, to treat this trust as a trust to honor the school children who are the beneficiaries of the trust for the schools, and to treat this trust with that high standard of honor that is your obligation when you took the oath of office and became a legislator, because it is the state that is the responsible party for enacting this trust.
Thank you. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I had a question for Representative O'Driscoll.
You know what? Let's catch Representative Wagenius first, if you don't mind.
That would be fine.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Representative Hilty. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, what I've been hearing in the description of what's happened in Utah, it seems obvious to me that there's some very different situations there, different resources, and the situation just seems to me not exactly comparable to what we have in Minnesota. And what I'm wondering is, what is your vision for Minnesota? How will this work here? What are you envisioning that would be different than what we're doing now?
Representative O'Driscoll, if you could make it very short, realizing you're going to be back here before this committee if you get out of education finance. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, thank you for your question. Well, the reason we have asked the folks from Utah to be here with us today is at one time their DNR was managing that land as well, and that the model that they're talking about, because of the unique nature of lands, is working for how they're setting it up. We wanted are advocating taking it out of the DNR and putting it into a separate management. And how we do that and how we craft that here in the state of Minnesota and how we proceed is still yet to be redrafted, if you will. More specifically to your question, how do I see that? As those assets are sold or reclassified from commodities, they may be invested in other financial instruments, so we're building an annuity for perpetuity where we're going to have money going into the next several centuries for the school children here in the state of Minnesota. And so our bill that we brought forward attempts to do just that, to build that structure.
Follow up, Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative O'Driscoll, what resources do you see that we have capable of being exploited for that purpose other than the timber resources that tend to be the focus of attention in Minnesota?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty. The list that you began is as a small part of that list. The other is there may be mineral rights that could be extracted and sold at the appropriate time. Again, if there's an oversight and a management on this and a plan, we may be able to maximize those resources, again, on behalf of the school children in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Hilty, follow up. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm not worried about a lawsuit, but one of the ways we could certainly avoid a lawsuit even coming is when we say to manage for natural resources, I think that's appropriate because we do have people hunting and fishing on those lands, which is really a good idea. We should just take some, we should, I believe, reimburse the trust fund for that opportunity to hunt and fish. Now, if you are going to put this into a another structure, then the other structure would charge the hunting and fishing community, and that's fine. But that is one of the things that has to be done. That's probably your first and best source of income. Anything about mining is a generation off, but paying for the hunting and fishing would be the first thing that it seems to me we should be looking at for an additional source of money. And that should be part of your bill.
Representative Fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess to the testifiers, I've got a question. I saw that the graph showed that there was quite an increase in the amount of revenue derived from school trust lands one way or another. How did that impact the general fund equivalent funding of education in Utah? Because ours, general fund for education, K-12, is not quite 40%, you know, between 37-40% of our general fund. So did that impact the general fund dollars that went to education?
Do either one of you know that? If you don't, maybe we could get Director Byrd.
I believe you're asking the money from the trust lands always went to education. The impact has been that what we call our weighted pupil unit is now separate, and there's a different program called the School Land Trust Program that puts some money into each school from the trust lands directly. But we are much higher than your percentage. We're closer to 45% for public schools.
That's your general obligation equivalent, or your general fund obligation equivalent of what would be going into schools?
Director Byrd.
45% is what, on the whole, on the average, the legislature commits to public schools from the state level.
Director Byrd, does that include higher education?
No, just...
Follow-up.
Well, thank you. I'm just trying to understand here because, I mean, if there's a supplant versus supplement issue, because theoretically if the school trust lands are producing additional resources and you kept the general fund level or support at the same level or equivalent, you'd be getting additional dollars per pupil, whereas you could scale back, theoretically, the general fund requirement of any type of school funding if you have additional revenue derived from school trust lands. And so actually... you may be really not enhancing the students' usage or their education level. You might just be reducing your general fund obligation of what is required to support education. I'd like to see the numbers.
Director Byrd, Representative Falk is wondering if the other money separate of school trusts has increased since 1994.
Oh, or have absolutely.
You Thank you. Representative Scott, you have the last question, then they're heading down the tunnel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Carter, thank you for being here. Just wondering, going back to Representative Hilty's question, do you believe that what you've done in Utah is somehow exploiting the natural resources or exploiting, are you exploiting anything in your endeavors?
Director Carter.
I'm interpreting your use of the word exploit as a negative connotation.
That's the way I took it.
Representative Scott.
And so,
yes, said.
So no, I don't believe so. As a matter of fact, I would challenge anybody to go and to point out an area where development on school trust land has created any greater problem or issue as development on federal lands with all of their regulations. Almost all of the mining that occurs on school trust land is regulated by another state agency who has conservation and protection of the resources as their mandate. So just because we issue a lease doesn't mean that something is going to happen, or if something does happen, that it's going to be a negative situation. And almost all of the development that occurs right now on trust land is done with adequate bonding and other protections so that there's reclamation and return of the land to former productivity after the uses, particularly mining uses, have occurred, and oil and gas uses. So no, I don't believe that because of the things that we've done that the environmental quality in Utah has been negatively impacted in one bit.
Thank you, Director Carter, and thank you, Director Byrd, for coming in. We appreciate your visit here in Minnesota. Representative O'Driscoll, you'll be back before this committee shortly. Next, we're going to switch gears and go on to Representative Fabian's bill. Is going to be before us in an informational purpose today, and be back here to vote on the matter tomorrow. And we want amendments on this bill tonight by the close of it by 1 o'clock. So that's where we're at. And Representative Torkelson is going to take over from here.
Welcome, Representative Fabian. If you would care to introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 2095 is a bill that I think is another step that's going to help us create more jobs in Minnesota. It's a bill that's going to provide for greater economic development. It's going to make Minnesota more competitive, all the while we're not lowering environmental standards. The permitting bill is somewhat of a bill that's a work in progress. It started out 2 weeks ago, I believe, in the Senate, and they had a hearing there. And after that hearing in the Senate, there have been some changes that have been made in the bill, and that's why you have the DE2 amendments in front of you today. So we are committed to working towards something that's that works for the agencies. Talked to Kirk Nedelka in the hallway before the hearing today, and I just want to help to keep Minnesota moving forward. And with that, what I would like to do is kind of turn it over to Tony here with the chamber to kind of run through the bill section by section. We'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Just a reminder to members that you do have a copy of the DE2 in your packets this morning. Mr. Quillis, would you care to introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And as Representative Fabian has pointed out, last year on a bipartisan basis, the legislature and the Dayton administration moved forward with some proposals in a bipartisan way to modernize and find some efficiencies or streamline, if you will, the environmental permitting and review process. Hopefully getting them, as the PCA Commissioner Austin likes to refer to it, up to the speed, operating at the speed of commerce. So we think this is important, Mr. Chairman and members, because decisions made by job creators and people that would like to expand or locate a facility here, one of the silos that they look at besides taxes and energy, workforce and workforce development is permitting and how long it would take, how much it would cost, and if there's a certainty at the end of the process. And so as they're looking at all of that and trying to locate a new or expand a facility here, this is one of the things that they look at. And unfortunately, as much as we'd like to keep it here in the state, these decisions are made either on a state, a regional, a national, or an international basis. So if we can get an advantage over any of the other places that they're looking to locate a new or expand their facility, we'd like to take advantage of that. And so that's why we'd like to try and move forward on some of the success that the legislature and the Dayton administration moved forward with last year. And that's why you see House File 2095 in front of you. And Mr. Chairman, as you pointed out, I'm going to work off a DE2 document and just try and go through it very briefly. I know there are other people from the agencies that would like to comment on it. I am here every day and I'm willing to come back later this committee meeting tonight, tomorrow morning. So if you want to, after I go through this, I can stand for questions or however you want to do and take the testimony from other folks. Like I said, I'm here every day, so it doesn't matter to me. But in Article 1, you'll see some language in there that deals with the DNR and some of the reports subsequent on the 150-day goal that we did last year. There was some suggestions by the agencies. You'll see on that deletion on lines 0.1, 0.4, and 1.5 of the subsequent reports on whether or not they were meeting the goal. This was at the request of the agency that when one of the report requirements was that when a project did not meet the 150-day goal, to go through and try and figure out when the action would be completed and the expected timeline to do that. Unfortunately, sometimes when they're waiting for information from the permittee, it's hard to put that in the report. So they asked that would be deleted, and we agree with them that it's probably one area that could probably help streamline that report. Within that language, you'll also see that we go through and delete some language. One of the issues that we've identified in the 150-day goal is, if you will, when the clock starts. As you can see, we talked about whether or not the project permit application was complete enough for processing when it was submitted. And there was 30 days to submit after the application was submitted, whether it was complete or not. We've run into some issues on whether the application is complete enough for submission or not, and whether the application is complete enough for processing, and when that clock starts. We're just trying to clarify here when the application is submitted, it is just the 150-day clock is to start. And you'll see that this is language is specific to the DNR. You'll see this language again in the PCA statute. Section 2 deals with suspension or interruption of government services. We unfortunately had this this last June, July, and so this would deal with a facility that has a permit in this instance from the DNR. You'll also see this language carried over into the PCA statute that if we're unfortunate enough to have a suspension or an interruption of government services again, that facilities in this state that have a PCA or DNR permit, as long as they abide by all the conditions and terms of the permit on the local, state, and federal level, that they will still be able to operate those facilities. Section 3 deals with state disposal system permits and feedlots. Feedlot permit goes from 5 years, where it currently is, to 10. We did something very similar to this last year for landfills. Section 4 deals with, you'll see the language again, and the deletion of the request of the agencies for what's required in the 150-day goal report that they submit twice a year, and the clarification language to, this is the PCA statute, on when the application, when submitted, starts the 150-day clock. Within that, then, on line 3.27, you'll see another option for project proposers in this state to use. Again, it is only an option and another tool in the toolbox, if you will. It is the creation of a permit applicant professional. That professional would be deemed as somebody that has an engineering license issued by the state of Minnesota and has 10 years experience in the subject area of the permit, whether it be water, land, or air. If a project proposer decides to go this route, they would notify the agency within 60 days, and then the agency within 30 days would let the project proposer and the permit application professional notify them of everything that would be required of them to submit an application. And you'll see those starting on 3.34 through 4.46. Those would be some of the things that would be required of the agency to the project proposer and the permit application professional. When that application data and information is submitted, when it is finally submitted to the agency, then the permit application and the permit would be deemed complete and approved, subject to a 30-day approval by the agency. And if it is rejected, they should cite the applicable statutes and rules. But they also must use and follow all public comment periods and all public hearings. And if you'll see, I'm going to drop down to 4.23 and 4.28. Also make sure that all the data is public and shall be requested by the agency. Again, this is only an option for the project proposer, and they would have to trigger this option and then find a permit application professional who wished to do this. And we can discuss that a little bit further, Mr. Chairman, after I get done with my comments. But 4.29 to 4.32 is the suspension or interruption of government services again for the PCA. It's the same language we discussed earlier that was in the DNR statutes. Section 5 deals with last year, if you remember, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it was in House File 1 as well as in the governor's executive order, where allowed by federal law, we allowed facilities that required a water permit to begin construction but to not discharge or emit, but at least allow construction because of our short construction season, to allow facilities to at least begin construction. This would carry it over except as prohibited where federal law, but for now for what we'll call minor air permits. Right now, we're allowed to grub and begin construction in concrete, but this would actually allow the commencing of construction, but there will be no emission or discharges from the facility, but just allow construction. Section 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 lead into Section 11. That is the creation of an environmental permits coordinator. If you remember this last fall, Representative Dill might have even been with them, the governor, Commissioner Austin, Commissioner Landwehr, Commissioner Sertich toured a number of economic development projects in northern Minnesota. Subsequent to that, the governor created a mining permit coordinator and a mining sub-cabinet within his administration. We thank him for doing that. We think that's a great idea to help promote that economic development tool up in northern Minnesota. But we also think that there are some folks in the agricultural area, in cellulosic and biofuels and alternative fuels arena, the agriculture area, who would also like to have access to this environmental permits coordinator. And so we spell out permits coordinator would be housed in the Department of Employment Economic Development. You can see some of the let me back up for a second, Mr. Chairman. This is an option. This is not mandatory. This is an option that a project proposer may use if so desired. You can see some of the requirements that we would like to see the permits coordinator look at, and then if a person proposing a project would go through and choose to go this route, some of the things that we ask the permits coordinator to do in terms of providing a list of all the permits, hopefully coordinating a plan of all the permits and decision-making practices, coordinate all the public comment periods if possible, and provide other assistance. So, and also 7.34, continuing on to 8.4, if a project proposer decided to use this option when they move forward on a project proposal, there would be a negotiation meeting between the project proposer and the Department of Employment Economic Development that the costs incurred by the permit coordinator would be paid for by the project proposer. Mr. Chairman, environmental Article 2 dealing with environmental review expands upon Governor Dayton's Executive Order 11.32, where he asked the Environmental Quality Board to go through and improve and evaluate, make recommendations for improved environmental governance and coordination. This would go through and ask the Environmental Quality Board to look at mandatory EAS and EAW categories to go through, and you see the three areas that we asked them to focus on, 8.20 to 8.24, the intended outcomes, the cost to state and locals, and then if the mandatory worksheet or mandatory environmental impact statements, some of which were done in the 70s and early 80s, whether or not subsequent to federal regulations and other changes, that they become duplicative, obsolete, or outdated, and report back to the legislature by December 1st of 2012. Section 2 of Article 2 deals with adding wood to the definition of cellulosic material. That would be, there are some proposals up in Grand Rapids and around Bemidji that those, hopefully those projects will take place. But this just adds wood to the cellulosic material definition. And finally, Mr. Chairman, last year the legislature made a change in ethanol, the mandatory requirement for ethanol plants at 125 million gallons. The mandatory requirement was those that were under 125 ethanol plants. This year we're just adding biobutanols and cellulosic biofuel facilities to that exemption. Mr. Chairman, I went through it very quickly, and like I said, I'd be glad to stand for any questions right now, but I know there are other people, including the agencies, that would like to comment on this and be more than willing to answer them now or come back later at your direction, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. With the understanding of the members, I think it would be best to take more testimony today. We have a limited amount of time. We'll have plenty of time for questions tomorrow. A reminder that the deadline for amendments is 1 o'clock. Today. So let's go ahead with more testimony. If there's no objection from the members, Jeff Smith from the MPCA is next on the list. If you to introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Smith, the Director of the Industrial Division of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I also would like to extend my thanks to the Chamber. I know they've been working and talking with us over the last couple of weeks to get this bill ready, or at least in a form that is, I think, more appropriate for the work that we're doing. So we've been working very kind of hand in the glove with the Chamber over the last few years. And since the permitting efficiency law kicked in last year, we've been meeting monthly, if not twice a month. So we really have been working hard with the Chamber and other folks interested in our permitting process to try and make sure that we are hearing and understanding and sharing ideas and following through on our commitment to be more efficient with our permitting process, while also making sure that we are complying with our charge to protect human health and the environment, also a key aspect to that. I think I'd like to start with, I'll just focus on some of the things that we're concerned about. At the high level, I think our general feeling is, at best, this particular bill is a bit preliminary. It's a lot redundant, and we're kind of covering ground already. At worst, it kind of backpedals on the good work that was done and the passage of the permitting efficiency law last March. I think it takes a step backwards in certain areas, and I'm disappointed to hear that, because we've really worked hard in the last year to beef up our process. We've spent many thousands of hours of staff time to comply with the permitting efficiency law. It's a good law. It helps us. The things we've done have really set us up to be more efficient in our permitting process, and it feels like we might be taking a step back. So I guess I'll focus on the issues that I think are of the greatest concern today and for the purposes of speed, and we certainly could take questions tomorrow if that's the case. So first of all, on 2.22, subpart 8, permit duration, 10-year permits for feedlots, we're still looking at that. There might be some opportunities for that for state permits. As you know, federal law requires five-year permit time for NPDES permits as well as air permits. But there might be some opportunities here that we can continue to explore. On the permit efficiency law, or on the next section, 4, line 2.29, you got that right during the passage of the permit efficiency law last March. It says within 150 days of the submission of a substantially complete permit application. That's when the clock starts. What you've heard today is from the Chamber is the proposal that the clock starts at day one of a submission of an application. It's important to understand that a permit is not a permit. We are not issuing a license to fish or hunt. We are not issuing a building permit like you might get from your local unit of government. We issue many thousands of permits to the tune of probably 18,000 facilities. We probably get 3,000 to 5,000 applications every year, and they are all very different permits. It is very easy on certain sorts of permits for us to issue them within a couple of days to a couple of weeks, and it's also very challenging on certain other permits for us to issue those in a few years. And you've been exposed to that, probably that whole breadth of the permitting actions, but this is an important piece because there are three things that drive the speed by which we issue permits. One is, obviously, PCA resources. We have staff working and able to work on permits, an important piece. The second important piece is the project controversial? The second becomes controversial. We've got folks that are concerned about the permit. That extends the time almost by definition. The third critical piece is when we've got a well-thought-out application, a well-thought-out project by the project proposer, and a complete application. That has been a weak point in this system in the past. We've spent the last year beefing that up primarily to make sure we are clear about what we're asking for in applications, and so that we can get a good complete application and I can get my folks working on those applications right away. And it's when we have delays because of poor information this lack of decision making, and we really see delays in the permit application piece. So our issue with this particular piece is leave it as it's defined right now. If you take away the chance for the permit clock to begin ticking upon the determination of a complete application, that puts the burden back on the agency and takes away the critical nature that the only way we meet this goal is when the project proposer, their consultant, if they've got a consultant, and the agency are working together. So this piece puts the pressure back on us, and the expectation then is that it's all in the agency's control, and for the most part, until the application is complete, we are waiting for the project proposer to submit good information to us. So moving on, I'd like to go down to line 3.27. This is a permanent applicant professional. I've been doing this job for over 20 years, and I have real doubts that those two definitions of a permanent applicant professional, an engineer's license, and has 10 years of experience in the program is going to get you what you want in terms of quality information. Are they helpful? Yes. In most of our permits, 90% of our permits do not require a professional, a consultant, to be part of the process. This particular piece, I think, draws some attention, unnecessary attention, on the idea that an engineer working in the program could provide great information, and it gives them the benefit of the doubt without any input from the agency. It seems to me that the agency should be the one that would be certifying a permanent applicant professional. And there's nothing in here about that. We work on this work, you know, permit work every day, all day. This is all we do. These limited scope in areas of meeting this definition is, in my mind, not sufficient for us to feel like we've got good information, a qualified person to be working on this. We absolutely support the idea that when an engineer or a consultant is hired by an applicant to work on an application or a permit, that is often a great thing. We want to get to those projects, and we encourage those when we know that the project is going to be controversial, very technical, and will benefit from a professional who knows the business. We've set up, in the last year, we've set up a process by which we want to identify those projects early on, and we want to get together with the project proposers and their consultants before they submit an application, because there we get to decide and help them kind of navigate and weave through the process. The next part that's of concern is beginning in 3.34. I understand the Chamber's bill and the desire for us to provide the information in beginning in 3.34 and going through 4.5, but unfortunately, there's no requirement that the applicant will give us any information ahead of time. We cannot give answers to 2, 3, 4, and 5 without some more detailed information from the applicant. So we'll be unable to comply with that. Moving on, again, I wanted to emphasize that permits are not permits. While a complete application, that's a great starting point, it is not the permit itself. In our mind, there is not a great benefit to getting, well, you just can't get a complete application and a draft permit at the same time for us to begin to review. Upon submission and determination that we've got a complete application, there begins the permit writing process. That is, for complicated processes and complicated permits, a iterative process where there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of technical review and conversation that happens between the project proposer, the agency, and their consultant. It is unlikely that submission of a draft permit along with a complete application by a professional is going to speed up the process at all. In fact, I'm concerned that we'll be determining almost on most of the cases that those applications are incomplete, which is still in our authority under this particular provision. I'm also afraid that the next thing that's going to happen, which is outlined in 4.17 through 4.22, which is the permit professional feels like they've been aggrieved by the agency's decision of incompleteness. and we'll have a lot more cases going to court. And again, that doesn't feel like a speed up to me. That feels like a significant slowdown in the process. So again, this whole concept of permit professional has a lot of issues, and try as we might, we just can't find a way to have this feel like this is a process that will speed up the entire process, and certainly will not benefit the applicant. Moving on to 4.29, line 4.29. I understand that the chamber was focused on issues around shutdown. Again, for us, the expiration of a permit is defined in federal law. All of our programs, or nearly all of our permitting programs, are defined in the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, and the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, RCRA, the Hazardous Waste and Tanks programs. We don't have flexibility in when permits expire. They will expire under federal law, and there's nothing that you can put in legislation that will change that. So this section, while I get the intent, seems redundant and somewhat unnecessary. Moving on to page 6, line 6.1, 6.3. Again, I understand that the intent here was that project proposers could begin construction without, you know, essentially turning the facility on, so they couldn't turn, emit, or discharge. We corrected this problem in the permitting efficiency law last year. There was a miscommunication in terms of language between the water program and the air program, federal law and state law, that was corrected. So as defined through all of the air programs and water programs and land programs, you can begin construction already under that regulation. And I get that it says except as prohibited by federal law. Again, this seems just redundant. It's already well defined in federal law. There's no benefit to having it played out in this particular citation here. It does not allow project proposers to begin and to do construction where they're not allowed under federal law. So, again, I'm unclear how this is helping move things along. Moving on to line 7.5. I think this is a deed process. I would remind the committee that the first stop process that was outlined by the governor last month does most of the work here. We agree with the concept here that we need to have the right people providing information and assistance where it seems appropriate. I'm not sure that having additional legislation different from the process we've already outlined with our folks from DEED and Department of Ag and the DNR is necessary. And then I think finally I'd like to touch on line 8.11. As Mr. Quilla said, this was already defined in the governor's executive order 11.32. As you know, the EQB is now part of the agency. We are carefully assessing and analyzing how to best use that organization and the authorities granted there. This is an important piece of understanding how to best use that, maintaining their charge to protect human health and the environment. And we are doing many of these things already. I'm a little worried that we'll have to do this mandatory evaluation before December 1st. That seems very challenging, and we'll be pulling staff away from doing permitting work to work on this analysis. This analysis is critical, but a little more time would be helpful. And I also think that this is something that we ought to do in a more regular basis. Certainly not annually, but one report is December 1st doesn't seem appropriate to me. We ought to be doing this as part of our normal ongoing process of evaluation. So every 5 years, something like that would seem to me more appropriate. I think I'll pause there. I appreciate your time, and I can take questions if that's appropriate now.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I think we'll move on with further testimony today. If Mr. Morris is here, we'll bring him to the stand. We only have about 3 minutes, Mr. Morris, so I realize that may not be enough, but perhaps you can touch on a few of the highlights. In the meantime, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Beard, would you care to approve the minutes of the last meeting?
Mr. Chair, I'll move that we approve the minutes of the last
meeting. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion passed. Mr. Morris.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout. We could, if someone could distribute those, perhaps. And my name is Steve Morris, with Executive Director with the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and I will try to be brief, given the time. Our coalition is the state's largest coalition of environmental conservation groups, with a combined membership of more than 450,000 Minnesotans. Just a few comments. First of all, I just want to remind folks why we have these permits. I know we all know this, but it's good to remind us, these are not construction permits simply to expedite the process. These are permits whereby we as a state and the public allow pollution of our air, land, and water to some degree. And this is how we limit the amount of pollution that goes into our air, land, and water as we're conducting our businesses. After listening to the PCA speak, I would sit back and say, why are we doing this? Let me suggest we give last year's bill a bit of a chance to work. House File 1 and the corresponding executive orders are being implemented. They're streamlining environmental review and permitting, and they are working. Let's give them a chance to work. As you know, there was a report that came out just last week, February 1st, with how that work is proceeding. 99% of 1,600 priority permits that the PCA have been submitted to the PCA were issued within the timeline of 150 days in the last year. Let me suggest if you pass this, you will not see those types of numbers again, simply because you're moving the goalposts. What you're allowing is you're allowing the clock to start ticking once someone submits an application, whether it's complete or not, with no indication of how complete it is, how it can actually be judged, or how it can be evaluated. The report has other excellent details that go into why the timelines were not met. Due to time, let me jump around here a little bit. Another factor I'd point out is the fiscal note. Last year, House File 1, as I recall, was about $500,000. When it was passed and no provisions were made to actually provide additional resources to the agency to implement House File 1. Now, they were sheltered a little bit from additional cuts, but no additional dollars were provided. So we have a staff that is stretched very thin with limited resources, and now we're implementing a system which is effectively a permit for sale. Let me suggest what we'd be better off doing is looking at the expedited permit process that's already in law, where an applicant can actually pay for the additional cost to have their permits implemented, which was done some time ago. The system that you're setting up with a hired consultant who is accountable to the company and not to the citizens or the state, actually submitting, developing, and fully developing the permit application and giving it to them is a clear conflict of interest. People who write the permits should be the paid professionals by the state of Minnesota who are non-partial and independent. They are the true permit professionals that should be referenced in this law. Oftentimes, the back and forth of the permit process improves the process, improves the product, and actually gets us something that is more meaningful. I won't go into the horse out of the barn provision. I think that was pretty evident that it's not necessary and is duplicative, allowing projects to be built before the permits are done. Last thing I want to mention is just the polling. It's easy to develop a belief of an alternative reality within the capital corridors. And so what we do is we go out and actually ask the public what they think about these things. And I want to cite two things from a recent poll which was done last month. 500 individuals done with a bipartisan polling, two bipartisan polling firms, Republican and Democratic firm. First of all, by a wide margin, no surprise, Minnesotans think we can have a strong economy and a strong environment. But on the back, we also asked people, what do you think? Our environmental laws, should they be made tougher? Are they tough enough, but should we actually do a better job enforcing them? Because a lot of people don't think we're doing a good job enforcing. Or are we about the right levels, or should we loosen up? Two-thirds of the public said we should have tougher laws or tougher enforcement. Another 20% said leave it alone. 12% said we should loosen environmental laws that we have in place. And that's effectively what this bill does. This bill, although you just heard the testimony, it doesn't really do much. The only thing it does do is maybe slow down the process, roll back environmental protections. We call it Rollback 2.0, and it's simply not something that the public wants to see or it is needed, as you just heard in the testimony. I think it's a dangerous bill, and you'll have time for testimony and Q&A tomorrow. I'd be happy to answer other questions, but I think we're about out of time.
We are about out of time, Mr. Morris. I'd like to remind members that if you have amendments for this bill, they're due by 1 o'clock tomorrow. We'll be hearing this bill and voting on it tomorrow. This 1 o'clock today, I'm sorry, I misspoke. The amendments are due at 1 o'clock today, not after the meeting tomorrow. With that, today's meeting is adjourned.